Faith is believing in something you can't see, you can't feel, something that can't be proven.
So then how do you know which is the right faith?
I think that's a gut thing.
I don't think about a right faith. I think about what resonates with me. I feel authentic. It brings me peace.
I think there is no absolute truth in any religion. I think it's a matter of subjective experience.
I kind of just trust my intuition, trust my gut.
You just know. You just gotta follow it.
You just gotta follow what you think is your faith.
If faith is blind, then what makes one belief better or worse than any other? And if it's just a leap in the dark, why should any of us feel obligated to believe anything at all? My name is Shane Rosenthal. I was raised in a Jewish home, but became an atheist at a very young age. Later, as I began to question things, I ended up losing faith in my atheism and converted to Christianity. Since that time, I've never stopped asking questions, and I've spoken with authors and scholars from all over the world in order to explore the beliefs and ideas that shape our lives. Over the years, one thing I've concluded is this. We're all believers. But because there are so many conflicting ideas and worldviews out there, we just can't all be right. So how do we find the truth? On this podcast, we'll start by asking questions.
I'm really just trying to figure out what I believe right now.
Hey there, welcome back to the Humble Skeptic Podcast. I'm Shane Rosenthal. And on this program, I'll be playing a lecture that I gave recently on the topic of Jewish views of the Messiah's mission. As Christianity grew and eventually became the official religion of the Roman Empire, over time, many in the West began to take it for granted. But what did ancient Jews before the time of Christ believe? Did they focus on a coming Messiah? And if so, what did they think he was coming to do? Did any of them believe that his mission was to atone for sin by some kind of sacrificial death? That's what I'll be discussing throughout this episode. By the way, if you'd like to take a look at my lecture slides that accompany this presentation, you can find a link to download a PDF copy in the show notes for this episode at humbleskeptic.com, along with many other related resources. So with that out of the way, here's my discussion of Jewish views of the Messiah's mission.
We'll start with just a general observation about Messianic Judaism, because I think this confuses people. There are some Jews who believe that Jesus is the promised Messiah, and they call themselves Messianic Jews. Some of them just call themselves Christians. So that's one part of Messianic Judaism. And then there's also Jews who believe in a person other than Jesus was the Messiah. There's a group of people who believe that this guy, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, a Brooklyn rabbi, was the Messiah. He died like in 1990 or something, 1995, somewhere in there. So they would be Messianic Jews. And then there are still others who believe that the Messiah is still yet to come. They're Messianic Jews, but they don't believe the Messiah has yet come. Well, all those three perspectives are a very small slice of the bigger pie. Most American Jews are not Messianic. They don't really focus on the Messiah. Sometimes they're just agnostic about it. They don't really talk about it. That's the kind of Judaism I was raised in. If you listen to a popular Jewish thinker like a Dennis Prager, he likes to talk about ethical monotheism. Okay, so that's where contemporary Jewish thinking is. You know, there is a God and he has rules and you should live by those rules with a grain of reality, but not a whole lot of emphasis on the Messiah. Now, sometimes you will ask these kinds of Jews, do you believe that there are Messianic texts? Sometimes they will say, yeah, but it's complicated. You know, there's so many different debates about it. We don't really focus on it. That's kind of what you get. Other times, what you'll get with non-Messianic Jews is sort of like our liberal Presbyterian. Liberal Presbyterians are like Machen would write, you know, he wrote a book, Christianity and Liberalism. He talked about it then in the 20s as a different religion. Same thing with many contemporary Jewish thinkers. They don't really believe in the Torah, except as a springboard for you to talk about contemporary politics, which is that's their home. So the majority of Jews in America are more of the secular Jewish type. They don't really focus on the Bible as a sacred text. They probably don't go to synagogue regularly. They probably don't read the Bible much. So this is the kind of background you just need to be aware of. When somebody tells you they're Jewish, they could be different kinds. And even if they say they're a Messianic Jew, there are different kinds of Messianic Jews. All right. Now, here's the question. What's the meaning of Messiah? What does this word even mean? Well, here's how we get the word Messiah. It starts in the Hebrew, Mashiach, which is the word anointed or to anoint. And that's something that ancient Jews did when they prepared someone for office. Office of a king, office of a priest, office of a prophet. Prophet, priests, and kings were the important office bearers. And that word Mashiach in Greek ends up being Christos, which is where we get the word Christ. Now, what's super interesting is that Jews before the time of Christ actually thought that there could possibly be more than one Messiah. So sometimes you'll read a Dead Sea Scroll and it'll talk about the Messiahs plural, the Messiahs of Aaron and Israel. When they say the Messiah of Aaron, they're thinking of the anointed one coming from Aaron, who is a priestly Messiah. And then the Messiah of Israel, the king who's going to reign. So they knew the Messiah would have a priestly function, but they kind of were thinking maybe it's a different person. And Christians obviously believe that it's one office for, or one person, three offices, prophet, priest, king. It was not until recent times that we've sort of made, you know, the separation of church and state. But if you go back to the ancient world, like ancient Rome, one of the titles for the Roman emperor was Pontifex Maximus. Okay, that sounds to us like the title for the Pope, but it's actually, it just means the highest priest. That's one of the titles for the Roman emperor. So in the ancient world, kingship and the priesthood were closer than we think, but Jewish thinking was different. They actually separated these offices so that King David can be censured by a prophet, right? So Nathan can come and say, what you're doing here is wrong. He tells him a parable and you are the man. You're not the highest person in the land. There's someone who represents God and makes you, the king, accountable. Very innovative in the history of the world. The text, though, behind us, where we find this word Mashiach, Psalm 2 is a great place to go, 1,000 years before the time of Jesus, so 3,000 years ago from today. And Psalm 2 says, the kings of the earth set themselves against the Lord, or Yahweh, and against his anointed. So that would be, and against his Mashiach. And the Lord said to me, you are my son. This is interesting too. Pay attention to this when you're reading the Old Testament. Notice the speaker. Who's doing the speaking? The Lord said to me, you are my son. So is King David speaking, or is it the personification of some future individual? Well, look at how it goes. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. Well, if you follow that trajectory, all these promises where the ends of the earth come into view, those are the end of time promises about the Messiah. And the Jews definitely pick up on that theme. And they say, this isn't David. This is David's greater son, the Messiah, the Mashiach. In Greek, the Christos. And you will find Greek texts talking about the Christ before Christ is born, because they were just picking up this theme using the Greek language. Now, here are some examples of Jewish thinking, Jewish quotes about the Messiah before the time of Christ. So here's a text called First Enoch, okay, probably written about 150 BC. And this refers to the Lord's Messiah. The Lord's Messiah shall give orders and be praised upon the earth. It's a future-looking text which sees a coming day where the Messiah of Israel will be praised around the world. The Dead Sea Scrolls, these two texts here, probably were written about 100 BC, so 100 years before Jesus. One of them says, heaven and earth shall listen to the Lord's Messiah. The other one says, when God has fathered the Messiah. That's an interesting one. When God has fathered the Messiah. It sounds similar to the language of Psalm 2. You are my son, today I have begotten you. So a text like this from the Dead Sea Scrolls is actually thinking that's a future promise. When God does father the Messiah, here's what's going to happen. A first century text called For Ezra, late first century text, one of the parts of it says, this is the Messiah whom the Most High has kept until the end of days, who will arise from the posterity of David. Okay, so from the end of days. Now, the Jewish perspective on the end is interesting. When you hear the end of the age or the end times, you'll see this in our Old Testament too. Sometimes it actually is thinking about the inauguration of the Messianic age, not the end of the world. This is the Messiah whom the Most High has kept until the end of days, who will arise from the posterity of David. The posterity of David, obviously, there are a lot of promises. One of them was Psalm 2. 2 Samuel 7, a huge promise where David says, you know, I'm going to build you a temple. And God says, I don't remember asking for one of those, but it sounds great. But I tell you what, I'm going to build you a house. And there he means dynasty. But this is going to be an everlasting dynasty. And that idea of it being an everlasting line gets echoed out throughout the generations. All right, so the Mishnah is another one of these Jewish texts. It's the Mishnah is the oldest part of the Talmud. So the Talmud is the oral teaching of Israel. They memorized all kinds of things from the first century, teachings from the rabbis, a liturgy, what do you do at the temple? They memorized it, and the oldest section of the Talmud is the Mishnah, probably gets written 200 years after the time of Christ. But it was memorized, so if you read it, a lot of the conversation is relating to things that are happening in the time of Gamaliel or, you know, the time of Jesus, really. And it says, with the footprints of the Messiah, presumption and dearth increase. Vine gives its fruit and wine at great cost. The government turns to heresy. It's picturing things corrupting before the time of the Messiah. A lot of different sources were emphasizing messianic ideas, though it's not as common today. Most forms of Jewish thought today are non-messianic. Most of the different sources before the time of Jesus seems like they were emphasizing the Messiah, and you could find many different examples. This last example here from the what's called the Targums, the Aramaic paraphrase version of the Bible, it's closer almost to a homily, where they're not just reading the text, but they're reading and interpreting at the same time. So it's twice as long. Because it's very interpretive. They're trying to help you as they're going from the Hebrew into their native tongue, Aramaic. They're explaining what they thought it meant. So when you read some of the text, you can see how they were interpreting it. There are probably hundreds of references to the Messiah in the Targums. In this case, this is a translation. It's an Aramaic translation of Isaiah 9:6. So that's the famous one that Handel takes and you hear it at the Christmas. For unto us a child is born, a son is given, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. Okay, so this is how it reads in the Aramaic when you translate the Aramaic back to English. The prophet said to the house of David that a boy has been born to us, a son has been given to us, and he has received the Torah upon himself to keep it. That part's added to the text, but that's what they were thinking the Messiah was going to do, that he's going to keep Torah. Well, why is it an important idea? Because very few have been able to keep it. I mean, doesn't it say that in Psalm 143? Do not bring your servant into judgment, for no one living is righteous before you. The Torah just sort of helps you to see your sin. It doesn't make you better. It just helps you see that you're not holy. And he will keep Torah, and his name has been called from before the one who causes wonderful counsel, God the warrior, the eternally existing one, the Messiah who will increase peace upon us in his days. Here, you find this continuation of that promise to David. When you go back to the David promise, at first it says two things. One, I will build you a house. I will build you a house. Then it says, a son who comes from your line will build the house, which is one of the reasons why Solomon takes this, he runs with it. I built it. I fulfilled the promise of my father. Didn't last very long though. Got destroyed. Jesus is the one that fulfills the two promises. It's God who builds and a son of David who fulfills, because he's God and he's man. And you find here this Jewish promise from the Aramaic speaking Jews. They're looking for the Messiah who is the eternally existing one who will increase peace in his days. All right, so I want to talk to you about this one particular scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls called the Melchizedek Scroll. And I'll start off by listening to a short blurb from Craig Evans. He's written a number of books on the Dead Sea Scrolls and about the Jewish roots of Christianity and the Gospels. And so here is just a short audio clip from Craig Evans talking about the Melchizedek Scroll.
The Melchizedek Scroll was found in cave number 11. And what we have are three columns of text, and it's the second column that's mostly preserved. And it is exciting. There's this vision that somebody will come and announce a jubilee, a forgiveness of debts in the future. And who's going to bring this about? Someone called Melchizedek, who's mentioned in Psalm 110. And the author of Hebrews in the New Testament runs with it and says, it's actually Jesus. He's the one who's this Melchizedek, who serves as high priest for his people forever. Well, you know, the men at Qumran seem to have a similar idea. I mean, it really is fascinating. The Melchizedek figure of the document we're talking about from Cave 11, he defeats Satan. He forgives God's people their sins. He restores them. In fact, in a certain sense, he's God himself. That, for me, is the most exciting part. We actually know this because the 11Q Melchizedek text quotes Isaiah 61:2, which in the Hebrew it says, to declare the acceptable year of Yahweh, the Lord. But in the paraphrase it says, to declare the acceptable year of Melchizedek. That's amazing. And so whoever this figure is, he's God in the flesh who comes to Israel and defeats Satan, forgives sin, and restores and heals his own people. And you can see why. My goodness, if there were ideas circulating in the first century, as evidently there were, about this Melchizedek figure, no wonder the author of Hebrews sees this fulfilled in the ministry of Jesus.
All right, now think about some of these lines from 11Q13. This is the Melchizedek scroll. What he was saying there is that the way Melchizedek is described, he's not just an ordinary guy. It's actually pretty clear as you look through this text that this writer names the Messiah Melchizedek for whatever reason. Look at some of the language from this Ditzy scroll. The year of Jubilee applies to the last days concerning the captives, just as Isaiah said, to proclaim the Jubilee of the captives. The Jubilee is this period mentioned in the Old Testament that has cancellation of debts and all kinds of things associated with it. Here, this scroll describes it as part of the function of the Messiah, the ultimate cancellation of debts, the ultimate Jubilee. This text says, he will proclaim to them Jubilee, thereby releasing them from the debt of all their sins. He shall atone for the sons of light. For this is the time decreed for the year of Melchizedek's favor. That's the part that Craig Evans was saying is really amazing, because it's a quote from Isaiah chapter 61, 2, which says this is the year of the Lord's favor, Yahweh's favor. And here, the person has replaced the name Melchizedek, because it's the name he's given to the Messiah, basically saying it's like an incarnation of God. This visitation is the day of salvation that he has decreed through Isaiah the prophet concerning all the captives. Inasmuch as scripture says, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messengers who announce peace, who bring good news, who announce salvation, who say to Zion, your divine being reigns. He's interacting with a lot of themes, mostly thus far from Isaiah. But now he's moved to the suffering servant passage. This scripture's interpretation, the one he just quoted, Isaiah 52, the mountains are the prophets, and the messenger is the anointed of the spirit of whom Daniel spoke. Okay. The anointed, the Mashiach, it's the Messiah. If it was written in Greek instead of Aramaic, it would have said the Christ. Okay, the messenger is the anointed, the Messiah, of whom Daniel spoke. Okay, so this is seeing the Messiah in passages from Leviticus. It's seeing the Messiah in passages from Isaiah 61, from Isaiah 52, and now from Daniel 9. After the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off. This passage that talks about the death of the Messiah. The messenger who brings good news, who announces salvation. It's the one of whom it is written, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort those who mourn, something Jesus says he came to do. And the very end of it, your divine being is Melchizedek. Okay, so you can't get any confusion about this. Whoever wrote this particular text, we know was Jewish. It's 100 years before the time of Jesus. He was seeing the coming Messiah as being a divine being who was going to atone for sin, cancel debt. He was going to fulfill these various prophecies from Daniel 9 and Isaiah 52 and 53 and Isaiah 61. Now, if you read the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're weird and wonky in some places, but they're seen through a glass darkly, right? Some of them believed in two messiahs, but it's very interesting. This one seems to be pretty clear that it's one and that he's a divine figure. Daniel Boyarin is a Talmud professor at the University of Berkeley, and he wrote a fascinating book, very easy to read, called The Jewish Gospels. And in this book, he talks about some of this stuff that actually, when you go back and you look at the ancient Jewish perspective, it's not as different as you might think, Judaism and Christianity. It's closer to Protestant Catholic. He says it's like that when you go back to the ancient Jewish world. One of the lines was that this anointed one, the Messiah, is the one of whom Daniel spoke, okay? And then it quoted a couple lines from Daniel chapter 9. Let's take a look at this passage and just see what Daniel 9 actually says about the Messiah. This Daniel 9 passage starts with, you know, the people are in captivity, and Daniel is saying, you know, there was a promise about a 70-year period that we'd be in captivity, and is this time period up? And he gets the message back from Gabriel. 77s, not just 70 years, but 490 years are decreed about your people and your holy city to bring rebellion to an end, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness. That's interesting too, the combination of those two. Putting an end to sin, but bringing in righteousness. Everlasting righteousness. To seal up vision and prophecy, to anoint the Holy of Holies. No one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until an anointed one, the Messiah, the ruler, will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. This is basically 483 years. It will be rebuilt with a plaza and a moat, but in difficult times, read the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, very difficult. After those 62 weeks, the anointed one will be cut off. The Messiah will be cut off. That word cut off is language for like death. The anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. Now that's something that Isaiah also talks about. So we're going to look at that from his angle too. The people of the coming ruler will destroy the city and sanctuary. This is the most interesting thing to me. Soon after the Messiah's cutting off, there is a ruler from a people to come who destroyed the sanctuary. Here we have a time frame. This happens sometime before 70 AD, because that's when we know the temple was destroyed and Jerusalem was laid waste. The end will come with a flood. Until the end, there will be war. Desolations are decreed. That happened. But then it goes back to the Messiah. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. And in the middle of the week, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. So the sacrificial system, he puts it into it by his confirming of a covenant. Now, this is prophetic language. It's weird. That week is a 7-year period because he's talking about these special sevens. And that becomes clear, by the way, if you look at the way the Jews interpreted this, they will talk about 7 weeks of years. That last week in the middle of it would be a 3.5-year period. And most of the Christian interpreters, you know, tend to say, in the middle of that week is when Jesus is crucified. And that's the confirmation of the covenant, the new covenant that was promised in the Old Testament. Turns out there are Jews who thought about this before the time of Jesus. Now, there's another line here from that Dead Sea Scroll that focuses on the visitation day of salvation decreed through the prophet Isaiah. Okay, so this is another line from the Melchizedek Scroll that's focusing on the Messiah. It's focusing on Isaiah's writings here. It's focusing on the suffering servant passage from Isaiah 52 and 53. That's the visitation that it's referring to, the visitation of the Messiah, the one who will come, the messenger of the covenant, the one who will be cut off, the anointed one. That's the one he's talking about here. So let's look at some of the lines here in this suffering servant passage from Isaiah 52 and 53. When you want to see ancient prophecies about the Messiah, this doesn't get much clearer than this. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of the herald who proclaims peace, who brings good news. The Lord has displayed his holy arm in the sight of all the nations. All the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God. See, my servant will be successful. He will be raised up and lifted up and highly exalted. His appearance was marred beyond human recognition. Wait, he's highly lifted up and exalted and yet disfigured, marred? That's got to be mysterious, right? So he will sprinkle many nations. That's the same language. When the priest would be in the Holy of Holies, he would dip the blood and sprinkle it on the mercy seat. Same word. But here, instead of it sprinkling the mercy seat to atone for Israel's sins on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, this is sprinkling many nations. And this is in the Hebrew text. Kings will shut their mouths because of him. It's going to go international. He was despised and rejected by men, but he's exalted. How could he be despised and rejected? He's a man of sorrows. He's pierced for our transgressions. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've all turned everyone to his own way. The Lord has laid upon him the iniquity of us all. He was cut off from the land of the living. There's that same cutting off language, just like we saw in Daniel. He's cut off. But here, it's clear that this isn't just a kind of a curse or a cut off from the community. This is cut off from the land of the living. He was struck because of my people's rebellion. They made his grave with the wicked. Okay, there's cutting off of the land of the living, and there's a grave with a rich man in his death. There's death. Rich man in his death. Okay, so Jesus happens to have Joseph Arimathea involved in his death. Rich man, very wealthy, expensive tomb. Although he had done no violence, there was no deceit in his mouth. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see light. He sees light. Wait, he's dead, and then he's seeing light. This is getting interesting. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. He shall divide the spoil with the strong. He's seeing light, and then he's dividing spoils at a victory celebration. I've never seen that happen at a gravesite. Have you? You bury someone, and then an hour or two later, they're celebrating. Have you ever seen that happen? Anyone? Now, check out what happens in this translation of this suffering servant song into the Aramaic. Okay, so this is an Aramaic translation written by Jewish believers. Here's what it says. Behold my servant, the Messiah. Aha, stop there. There are a lot of Jews who say the suffering servant passage is not about the Messiah. It's a personification of Israel's suffering. Okay, well, these Jews thought it was about the Messiah. The Messiah will be successful. He will be lifted up and increase and be very strong, and he will scatter many nations. Notice the strength of the Messiah here is being emphasized, not his weakness. And he is going to scatter. That's the passage that was, he will sprinkle. Here, it translated to scatter. He's going to be a victorious king and scatter all the nations. Kings will be silent on account of him. Then the glory of all the kingdoms will become a disgrace and will be cut off. Guess who gets cut off in this song? The enemies, not himself. So this is a theology of glory. It's like the Messiah is going to conquer his enemies. They're the ones who get cut off. They will be weak and sick. Like a man of suffering, they're the ones who are suffering and weak and pitiful. They are despised and not esteemed. Then our iniquities will be forgiven on account of him. Even though you disagree with it, because it's obviously interpretive, it still is saying this is about the Messiah, and he resolves the problem of sin and iniquity. We have gone into exile, each to his own way, and it was pleasing from before the Lord to forgive all of us our sins on account of him. Again, very clear language of forgiveness in light of what the Messiah does. He will remove the rule of the nation from the land of Israel, very strongly getting rid of all of our enemies. They will see the kingdom of their Messiah, again, naming the Messiah. He will deliver them from the servitude of the nations. By his wisdom, he will justify the righteous. What? That's not what it says. This translator interprets this to mean its exact opposite. He's going to justify the righteous. Common sense, right? The righteous people get justified. And well, Paul wrote the very opposite, right? God justifies the ungodly. So here we have, he will justify the righteous to subject many to the Torah. You know, this is the thing that the Gentiles need. They need our Torah. Well, Jesus sort of says, yeah, we're not going to abolish it, but it's going to be fulfilled. It's fulfilled. So he is righteousness incarnate. He came to fulfill, and a lot of it was temporary to exclude, to separate different clothing, different diet, different air, all these different things to separate so that you have a community that would last over a millennium. He will justify the righteous and subject many to the Torah, and he will entreat for their sins. There's still a little bit of truth in there. Then I will divide the plunder of many nations for him because he handed his life over to death. Look at that. These people believe that there was going to be a coming Messiah who would resolve the problem of sin, and in somehow in the process, he would die. Now, there's a lot of stuff in here that doesn't seem like a faithful translation, but still, you can tell this is not a Christian text, right? All right, let's talk about this ancient Qumran hymn. This particular hymn is found in many different Dead Sea Scrolls. And here are the lines from this ancient Qumran hymn. You can see this hymn they were singing in the 100 years before the time of Jesus was definitely the main passage they were alluding to was the suffering servant from Isaiah 52 and 53. There are none comparable to me in my glory. No one besides me shall be exalted, for I have dwelt on high in the heavens. I am reckoned with the divine beings, and my abode is in the holy congregation. Who is considered as contemptible as I am? Wait a minute. This is a divine being in the council of the heavens, but he's contemptible. And who has been despised like me? Who is rejected by men? Ah, now I'm picking up the allusion. That's Isaiah 53, verse 3. Despised and rejected. Who is comparable to me in my glory? Who has borne troubles like me? Probably Isaiah 53, 4. To whom shall you compare with me in my teaching? For I have dwelt on high in the heavens. Who is like me among the divine beings? Who can endure the utterance of my lips? For I am beloved of the King, and to my glory no one compares. Light shines out, joy pours forth, fear ceases. A fountain for eternal blessing opens, iniquity is ended, and guilt shall be no more. So this hymn is looking at the days of the Messiah, who is a suffering Messiah, who is rejected, despised, who bears trouble, and who somehow ends up resolving the problem of iniquity and guilt. This definitely is pre-Christian, okay? And this doesn't have that sort of theology of glory. The Messiah, when he comes, will conquer the Gentiles and become the new Caesar. This is, I think, a little closer to the text itself, as we find it in Isaiah. And it's definitely finding a suffering Messiah who atones for sin, ends iniquity, and is despised by his own people. Now, here's an interesting figure, Flavius Josephus. And he writes about the Jewish history. It was first written in Aramaic, he says so. He translated his work into Greek. Now, there are different editions of Josephus' writings, and some people think maybe the best way to account for these different editions is to suggest that somebody had an Aramaic translation, and then that made its way into the modern-day copy we have called the Slavonic edition. Now, I happen to have the Slavonic edition. Now, this is $171 for this one book. But if you go through this, it has the standard edition of Josephus on one side and the new edition, so you can see that there are some areas where there is material added on one side that's not in the other. Now, there are people who think it's just too weird, we don't know what to do with it, and we don't ever let anybody know that it exists. I'm not one of those guys. Here's what the Slavonic says. This is one of these sections. It's in the Slavonic edition, but not in the normal. It's a conversation that happens maybe 42 BC between priests who, when Herod just comes into power. When the priests met to discuss Herod's rise to power, one of them said, "We know that Herod is an Arab and uncircumcised. The anointed one, the Messiah, will be called meek, but this king has filled our whole land with blood. Is he the hope of the nations?" Notice there, they think the Messiah is going to be the hope of the nations. He's not just going to be an Israeli king. He's going to be the new Caesar. That's the way a lot of people envisioned it. The Caesar would no longer be in Rome. The new king of all the earth would be in Jerusalem. Is he the hope of the nations? Consider Daniel's prophecy, for he writes that after the return of the exiles, the city of Jerusalem will stand for 77s, that is for 490 years. This is the way they're saying it, and then will be laid waste. But the Holy of Holies, where is he? Notice it doesn't think of the Holy of Holies as a place. It thinks of the Holy of Holies as a person. That's revolutionary. This is exactly what Jesus did. He said, you know, destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. For the prophet cannot be calling Herod holy, for he is bloodthirsty and foul. There were a lot of people who thought Herod may be the Messiah. And these people thought, no, that can't be, right? Now, I think there is some merit to this. I think it fits with the period because there's a lot of expectation about the period of the time of Jesus. A lot of false prophets claiming to be the Messiah in the time of Jesus. Why? Because there's this expectation of what's going to happen here. A lot of the pieces fit. And here are three sections of Josephus that help to explain this. Josephus writes in his Jewish War, what did elevate the Jews undertaking this war? Talking about the Jewish War, starts in about 62, 63, echoes of war, 66 really gets going. What undertook this was an ambiguous oracle that was found in their sacred writings that about that time, one from their country should become governor of the entire earth. Now, this oracle certainly denoted the government of Vespasian. Now, here's what's interesting. The Slavonic edition is a little different. So if this is the first Aramaic edition, not the later Greek, here's what it said. Some thought it referred to Herod, others the crucified miracle worker, others Vespasian. When Vespasian can read this in his own language, look at what it says. This oracle certainly denoted the government of Vespasian. It's a little different, isn't it? Here now it's just, this was certainly Vespasian. By the way, do you know what, anybody know here what Vespasian's first name is? You're going to like it. It's the Flavian Empire, Flavius Vespasianus. Flavius, guess what? That's the name Josephus has. He became sort of like, he was brought into the Flavian household, and he writes puff pieces for Vespasian. Doesn't sound like a very good Jewish thing to do. Like, you may be our Messiah. This is one of those reasons where it makes me have a little bit more trust in the Slavonic edition, that maybe there is some stuff here that was the early edition of Josephus' works. Because we do know that there were a lot of Jews in the first century up until the 60s that still believed in Jesus. And I'll prove it to you by reading this next quote from Josephus, from the Standard Edition. Festus was now dead. Festus is the guy that Paul meets with in Acts chapter 26. He is now dead. Ananus, who, by the way, is the son of Ananias in the New Testament. He has five sons. One of them is named Ananias Jr. Spelled a little differently here, but same guy. So Ananias assembles a Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them James, the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ. It refers to James, the brother of Jesus. And James is a leader of the church. And this priest here, this is about 62 AD. This is not mentioned in our New Testament, not mentioned in our book of Acts. But James, as a leader of the church, we know he's a leader of the church. He appears to be so in Acts chapter 15. He also writes an epistle, the book of James. They formed an accusation against him as breakers of the law, and they delivered him to be stoned. But the most equitable of the citizens disliked this, and they had King Agrippa take the high priest from him. So this was offensive, what this priest did. So he was deposed for it. That guy only reigned as a high priest for 3 months. Well, that means to me, in the 60s, you still have a high support for the crucified miracle worker guy. And a lot of people still believe that he's the Messiah. Otherwise, you couldn't have this person in a position of high power in Jerusalem, the brother of Jesus. So you still have a bunch of people at the time believing that Jesus is the promised Messiah of the Jewish text. Last text I want to highlight to you here from Josephus is from his Antiquities, where he says of Daniel, Daniel didn't only prophesy of future events as did the other prophets, but he also determined the time of their accomplishment. He said that there should arise a certain king that would despoil the temple and forbid the sacrifices to be offered for 3 years' time. And indeed, that came to pass, and our nation suffered this under Antiochus Epiphanes. So he's thinking of certain sections of Daniel, maybe chapter 8 and others. There are a couple of different abominations of desolation. One of them happens to be related to Antiochus Epiphanes, 150 years before the time of Jesus. In the very same manner, Daniel also wrote concerning the Roman government and that our country should be made desolate by them. Here, he's thinking of that Daniel 9 passage that talks about this roughly 500-year period from the time of the exile to the Messianic period, and then just a little bit after that, boom, the Romans come and desolate Jerusalem. Well, the Messiah comes before that. And Josephus, as we saw, explains it because Vespasian's that guy. Josephus, he was a soldier in the Jewish War, probably born in the 40s, and he's, you know, fighting the Romans. He gets captured. He actually tells Vespasian, you're going to become the emperor. And he said it in a way that was kind of prophetic, and it ended up coming true. And Vespasian liked that. Because of what he says about Vespasian being the Messiah, I actually think Josephus is a false prophet. This just goes to show he believed in a Messiah. He just interpreted it differently. Thank you.
Folks, thanks for joining me for this episode. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, if you'd like to check out some of the sources I quoted from throughout my lecture, you can find them in the PDF copy of the lecture slides that I've made available in the show notes at humbleskeptic.com, where you'll also find information about upcoming events, such as a conference that I'll be speaking at this weekend in the greater Memphis area on the cross and resurrection. You can also find out information about how to support this podcast by making a one-time gift or by upgrading to a paid subscription. The address once again is humbleskeptic.com. That's humbleskeptic.com. And I look forward to being with you again next time as we discuss the beliefs and ideas that shape our lives.